Have you ever heard a musical artist described as having great chops? What does that mean? Well, the term chops is slang in the music business that refers to an artist that has developed great skills over time, whether they are a musician, composer, producer, or other titles associated with the music business. This is Scott Grimaldi, your host of Got Chops. Join me as I interview one musical artist per episode that I've had the pleasure of either performing, recording, or work with in my career. Plus, I'll be interviewing artists I've always wanted to speak with. We'll discover how each artist developed their chops, listen to their stories, and much more. This is Got Chops. My special guest artist for today is a recording engineer, guitarist, and owner of Surefire Recording Studios in Long Branch, New Jersey. That's him on the track behind me, playing guitar on his composition, Wild Honey, that he recorded and mixed for his band, The Killin' Floor Project. He started playing guitar at 9 years old, studying with John Harrington from Steely Dan and jazz great Tal Farlow. My guest has worked besides two of the most respected recording engineers of all time, Andy Johns and Eddie Kramer, and has engineered at Abbey Road Studios in London, England. He has worked with or recorded at Surefire Recording Studios with iconic artists that include Blondie, Bon Jovi, and Bruce Springsteen, just to name a few. In addition, he plays lead guitar in the tribute band Pure McCartney. This multi-talented recording engineer, guitarist, and entrepreneur certainly got chops. Please welcome Joey DeMeo. Good morning, Joey. This is Scott from Got Chops. How are you?
Hey, Scott. I'm great. First of all, let me thank you for having me on your show. I've been really looking forward to doing this interview with you.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to interviewing you. So for my listeners, Joey DeMeo and I have been friends for many, many years. He's an outstanding recording engineer and owner of the legendary Surefire Recording Studios in Long Branch, New Jersey. I know him from the other side of the glass where I would be in recording sessions as he's manning the board. As a recording engineer, session guitarist, and owner of the legendary Surefire Recording Studios, what does the music slang Got Chops mean to you?
Well, first of all, let me just say you're way too kind calling Surefire legendary, but it's much appreciated. You know, Surefire has been there for a minute. But as far as the term Got Chops is concerned, for me as a guitar player, and a musician, of course, it means to me someone that can really play, someone who could really solo and improvise, whether it's a guitar player, obviously, or, keyboard player, any musician that could play, really, they could read phenomenally well, and they could just, they're just almost a virtuoso in their talents, is what I would consider Got Chops meaning.
Absolutely. Great answer. So do you hear other musicians in your studio use the same music slang, chops?
Occasionally, I would think it, when I do hear guys talking about, it's mostly the older cats, because I would imagine that term, came from, I don't know where it originated or how it originated, but I would think it would be, certainly, 40s, 50s, 60s, maybe, So, yeah, it would definitely be, some of the, more seasoned guys. I don't think I've ever heard any of the younger kids use that term. But, yeah, people still use it occasionally in the studio. Absolutely.
So you hail from the Jersey Shore. Where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Jersey City. My family, was originally from Jersey City. I was born at Christ Hospital, and we lived there until I was, I'd say nine. And then at that point, we moved to Belmar in Monmouth County, New Jersey. My father's mother had been down here for many years prior to that. She owned a home, and I guess she was the original, like, Airbnb. She had a bed and breakfast. And, you know, so that's what she did. She had this, you know, huge house in Belmar, and, you know, she cooked, and, you know, so in the summertime, you know, she always had, you know, many, many guests, you know, because Belmar was a great place to spend your summers. At, you know, I mean, it still is, but, you know, back then it was, you know, a little bit less hectic, for lack of a better term, down in Belmar and in that whole kind of southern Monmouth County area. So, yeah, so born in Jersey City, and then when I was nine, we moved to Belmar. And I've been in Monmouth County ever since.
It's a great area. It really is great.
Yeah, you know, I feel blessed to have grown up here. You know, it's, you know, we moved around a little bit, you know. So, I mean, I was, you know, like I said, we were in Belmar. We had a home in Bradley Beach. Also, my father was very friendly with Frank Sinatra growing up. So we lived in Palm Springs, you know, because my father and Frank were close friends, and I had spent time around Frank, and so then we came back to New Jersey, and yeah, so I've been here ever since. I got married, you know, we lived in it's been Monmouth County pretty much my whole life.
Wow. I can see a part two of this podcast just talking about the connections your family has with Frank Sinatra. Wow.
Yeah, it was a special time for sure.
Ooh, I'll have to talk to you more about that. I mean, in all the years I've known you, I never heard that. Wow.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, it's a very fond memory, of course. And, you know, I don't feel the need to have to, you know, exploit it for any, you know, any reason other than, you know, it, you know, it was just a great time in our lives for sure.
Did you come from a musical family?
You know, not that I really know of specifically. You know, my mother always told me that her father was an opera singer in Italy. But, you know, I mean, I have, you know, many cousins on my mother's side that play, you know, that are singers and guitarists and play piano. And, you know, there's a few on my father's side, but, you know, it wasn't specifically like, you know, my household, my father was a concert pianist, or, you know, my mother was a, you know, concert violinist or anything like that. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, it's in the blood, but, you know, it wasn't, you know, directly from my parents, as far as I know. You know, I mean, it was their parents and probably more from the old country.
Well, oftentimes we pick up things in our genes, you know, it skips a generation.
Right, exactly.
So what age did you begin to play and study music? And I know that you're a guitarist, so was guitar your first instrument?
Yeah, so when we moved down to the shore, you know, my mother, you know, she was really... I guess she was ahead of her time, but she saw that I was, you know, having a hard time, you know, kind of simulating in and making friends. And she, you know, wanted me, you know, to take music lessons, you know, and she brought me to a local music store in Belmar, and she bought me my first guitar, and that's how it started. Yeah, when I was nine, as soon as we, you know, pretty much moved down to the shore. So yeah, guitar was my first and primary instrument, and, you know, still is, of course. You know, I dabble on, you know, pretty much anything that has a string on it. You know, I could make a noise out of it, whether it's a mandolin or a banjo or a bass or whatever. But yeah, so it's always been guitar for me.
And I know you study privately with the legendary studio guitarist John Harrington, who has been a band member of Steely Dan since 1999 and recorded on a number of their great albums. So when and where and how long did you study with him?
Yeah, so John was my first guitar teacher, you know, when I first started taking lessons. Yeah. So when I was a very young boy, John Harrington was teaching guitar at a local music store in Belmar called Blue Note Music. And, you know, that's who I wound up, you know, taking lessons from. And it was, you know, a huge, huge, you know, influence on me. And you know, I'm really indebted to John, you know, for inspiring me, of course, because he's such a, you know, phenomenal player. You know, even when I was, you know, just picking it up, I knew the talent that he has. You know, and then of course he's just a wonderful human being in person, you know, really. You know, I love John to death. And so, yeah, I studied with John, you know, when I was young, for several years. And then, you know, I kind of took a break from lessons. And then when I was older and I was driving, I studied with John again privately. He would sometimes come down to the area and give private lessons at other people's homes. And, you know, he would come to my home or I would go to his home. Yeah. So I studied on and off with John for at least 10 years.
Wow. So was that during the time that he was with Steely Dan?
No, that was much prior to that. That would definitely have been, you know, in the 70s and early 80s. Yeah. So I guess he probably didn't start with Steely Dan, maybe the late 90s, early 2000s. So somewhere in that area, I think, is when he started his tenure with them.
Did he ever tell you how he got that gig?
You know, we never really talked about it, so I don't know. But I can only assume that he was, you know, friendly with the guys, you know, being in New York, and they must have heard of him, you know, and seen him play. And, you know, because John is just, he has chops. You want to talk about somebody who has chops?
Oh, he does.
There you go. Yeah. You know, just a, you know, phenomenal improviser. He comps chords like nobody's business, you know, and he could read, you know, he's just all around, you know, he's a triple threat there, I would say.
His sound, that's his signature talent right there. I mean, he does all the above that you just mentioned, but what a biting sound, and he's right in the pocket.
Yeah, well, isn't that, you know, usually a sign of someone that is in demand, right? You know,
right.
I mean, you could play, you know, you could read, you have a great sound, you know, and I tell that same thing to a lot of people, you know, when they come into the studio to record, you know, they want their drums to sound like this, or they want their, you know, guitar to sound like that. And I said, yeah, well, those are all great references. And I understand, you know, what you're looking for, but, you know, it has to start at the source, you know, if it doesn't sound good at the source, if you're not hitting the drums a certain way, or if you're not attacking the guitar a certain way, you know, it's not going to translate on the recording. So, but yeah, you know, back to John. Yeah, I mean, his touch and his feel and his phrasing and his timing are just impeccable.
So I read that when you were 18 years old, I didn't know about this, you opened your own retail music store called The Guitar Place in Bradley Beach, New Jersey. What was that experience like to be an entrepreneur at such an early age?
Yeah, and at that was a great time as well in my life. Yeah, right out of high school. You know, I have been, you know, so from studying with John and I, you know, we didn't talk about it, but also I studied with Tal Farlow for a little bit. Tal also taught at Blue Note Music. They had several stores in the area, and he taught at the Long Branch store. So, you know, I had, you know, Tal as one of my teachers and John. So I became, you know, relatively proficient at guitar early. You know, I don't want to say it came easy to me, but I adapted to it, you know, playing, and, you know, it was pretty natural thing for me. It just, I don't know, for whatever reason, you know how it is. Some people, you know, just take the different things and they excel at them, and others, it's more of a struggle. It was never really a struggle for me to play guitar. I mean, obviously, you know, they're so many guitar players in the world that are just phenomenal. And I'm not even remotely suggesting that at all, but it came relatively easy to me. And I wound up teaching guitar when I was 16.
Wow.
So I was teaching guitar for a few years. And then once I graduated high school, I had a friend of mine that, you know, wanted to, you know, start a business. He was he was a little bit older than me. He was in his 30s at the time. And yeah, we said, okay, well, you know, we found a spot in Bradley Beach. And, you know, we basically catered to just guitar and guitar players. You know, we bought and sold used guitars and amplifiers. We gave lessons. We did repairs. We had a couple of new lines. We carried Randall amplifiers at the time that we were able to secure them as one of our Yeah, it was one of our dealers that we had. You know, we had deals with D'Addario strings and different companies like that. So, you know, we did sell some new stuff, but mostly it was buying and selling used guitars. You know, we had accessories, of course, you know, amplifiers, like I said, and lessons. Lessons were a big part of the business, of course.
Wow. So where in Bradley Beach, and what were the years that you had that store operating?
So it was on Main Street in Bradley Beach, directly across the street from the post office. So I'm not sure what the two side streets are there. It might be Brinley Avenue on one side, and maybe Fifth on the other. I'm not positive. Yeah, but it was right on Main Street. It was a little shop. You know, I would certainly would have called it a mom and pop shop back then. It wasn't, you know, very big, but we had several booths for lessons. We had a repair shop in the back, and of course we had the storefront where we had the guitars and the amps and things like that. And so as far as my time frame, I wasn't there very long. I kind of got frustrated is not the word, but I realized, you know, relatively fast that I didn't want to be in retail. It wasn't something that I enjoyed. You know, I enjoyed the teaching part of it, but as far as sitting behind a counter and, you know, answering the phone and waiting for people to come in and dealing with sales reps and all that stuff, that's not what I wanted to do. So I would say about 2 or 3 years I had it. And then, you know, I sold my portion of it to my partner, and he kept it for many years after that.
Is it still in existence?
It is not. Yeah, he had closed down some years ago and moved to Florida. Yeah, so.
And so besides the guitar, when did you also become interested in recording engineering?
That's a really great question. You know, so growing up, you know, I was obviously fascinated by the guitar. And I should, you know, I really have to thank my cousin, Johnny Flora. I mean, he's really the first one to show me anything on the guitar. When I first got my guitar, he showed me how to play Smoke on the Water, which I guess is a, you know, pretty much like playing Stairway to Heaven, although Stairway's a little bit harder to play, you know, when you're first learning how to play. But he showed me Smoke on the Water, and then I was, you know, captivated with that. But so, yeah, once I started playing and, you know, listening to music growing up, of course, you know, there was a lot of music in my house, and I was always kind of fascinated with both parts of it. You know, I love the guitar and the playing part of it, but I was also very, very interested at an early age of, you know, what that sound was. You know, wow, I mean, what is that? You know, why does it sound like that? You know, man, that sounds great. And really the thing that really set it off for me was the first time I heard A Whole Lot of Love by Led Zeppelin. That guitar riff was just, it was like, oh my God, what is this? There was just so much raw energy in that performance of that and the sound of it. I mean, even to you know, today when I hear that song, I listen to the recording. I mean, it still sounds relevant to me, even though it was recorded in, you know, 1969 or 1970. I mean, it's just so much energy there, and just the sound of everything was just so captivating to me. So they both kind of went hand in hand for, you know, pretty much from the beginning for me.
Wow.
Which is interesting, yeah.
Well, you know, recording sessions, as you and I both know, you either capture the moment or you don't, and the sound has a great deal of why you can capture that moment. So I agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, it's got to, you know, I've always said that, you know, it has to move you, you know,
yeah.
Music should move you in some way, shape, or form, you know, make you happy, make you sad, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, if there's no emotion in it, then why are we doing it, right? I mean, that's, you know, hopefully as musicians, that's what we're trying to, you know, to give off to our audience and our listeners, is that, you know, that there's some feeling and an emotion in what we're trying to, you know, say or play, you know.
So talk about the recording engineers that inspired you to pursue this career path.
Yeah, well, you know, initially, you know, I had no idea what a recording engineer was. You know, I just knew that, you know, I liked the way that the music sounded, you know, and I was just fascinated with it. But obviously, as, you know, I got older, you know, I realized that there were people that were involved that, you know, captured those sounds. So, you know, growing up when I did in the, you know, early 70s and all the music that was always playing in my house, I have older siblings. So, you know, my sister was/is still a hippie. You know, she was at Woodstock and Altamont, you know, she was there for all that stuff. So I heard all of the stuff from, you know, that era, you know, like I said earlier, growing up, my parents always played, you know, Sinatra and you know, the standards in the house. And I have an older brother that was into more rock and roll. So, you know, those influences were really big. But for me, what I grew up, you know, really loving was, now the term is classic rock. You know, it was the Beatles, it was the Stones, Led Zeppelin, The Who, you know, bands like that, all of those British bands, the British Invasion bands. And when I was old enough to finally, you know, have a concept of what was going on, of course, it was, you know, Jeff Emerick who recorded the Beatles. And then really, you know, later on for me, it became Andy Johns, who recorded Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones, and his brother Glenn Johns, who recorded the same band, Zeppelin, the Stones, The Who, and of course Eddie Kramer, Jimi Hendrix. So, you know, those were the guys. I wouldn't say that I looked up to them because I didn't know what they did or how they did it, but I knew that they recorded those records, and those were the sounds that I loved, you know, and enjoyed and wanted to, you know, someday try and capture myself if I could.
Who did you study recording engineering with?
Well, that's an interesting question, and the answer is no one.
Wow.
I taught myself, and I'll be kind of brief on it, but my first recording experience was at Surefire when I was 15, when the studio first opened in 1978. I was so unhappy with the way that it came out at that point in time that I just said, you know what, I'm going to do it myself. I'll figure out how to do it. And that's kind of how I started in this path, is that, you know, I bought, you know, some little stuff, whatever I could find, a little tape recorder, a little two track, a microphone here or there, whatever it was. And I just started experimenting on my own, you know, and it's not that, you know, the first time you walk into Surefire, as you know, it's a great big room. It's very intimidating.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, I'm sure a lot of it, the reason why I wasn't happy with it was my own performance and inadequacies, you know, that happened during the recording session, you know, but I didn't realize it at the time, but you know, I'm sure there was a lot of intimidation there, you know, so when people come in, I realize that, and I try and make them as comfortable as possible and let them know, say, look, you know, I know it's a big room, it could be intimidating, but just relax, you know, I'm not going to have any pressure. I'm not going to, you know, try and dictate anything to you as far as what, you know, how the session is going to go. You tell me what you want to accomplish, and, you know, we'll try and, you know, get to that goal.
Well, let me piggyback on that, if you don't mind.
Of course.
I've been a recording session musician for many, many years for different producers and studios in the tri-state area. And I did find that when I first met you, which we'll talk about in a little while, I don't want to be stereotypical here, but most of engineers, besides being an engineer, want to be a producer, or they are a producer, and right away, they start to give their input, their two cents, or after you leave a session, you'll come back and they'll go, oh, listen, I fooled around with that track that you did. Let me play it for you. I'm going, who gave you permission to do that? Well, you know, I've got connections and, oh, that's cool, but I'm not paying you for that. If I want to go that direction, fine. Please don't do that with any of my tracks until I give you permission. You're not that person. You're not that guy. And I appreciate it. But when I do ask for your opinion, you're very honest and open and very nice about your delivery. And yeah, there's no pressure from you. It's wonderful.
Well, that's amazing that you bring up that point, because, you know, that's really nowadays, especially, I find it to be so true. And I think it's really a great line. And I try and tell new clients coming into the studio, say, look, you know, you want to do your recordings here at Surefire? That's great. You know, I mean, I'll do everything I can to, you know, to make you, you know, make it a pleasurable experience and, you know, get you what you're looking for. But, you know, I'm the engineer on this session. I'm not the producer, you know, and I try and tell people that going in, because they don't know. They just assume that, you know, especially newer kids, you know, and I guess the newer generation of how records are made, you know, it's usually just one person that records it, that, you know, is producing it, is engineering it. And I said, no, that's not really how it's supposed to go. You know, I mean, a producer is someone that you work with way before you come into the recording studio. You know, a producer will come to your rehearsals, you know, they'll work on arrangements, you work on parts, you work on guitar solos, you work on harmonies, all of those things. That's something that, you know, really shouldn't be happening in the studio, because, you know, you're wasting valuable time and money, you know, at that point. So yeah, I'll say, look, if there's something going on and you ask me my opinion and I have an opinion about it, sure, I'll voice it, but I'm not going to, you know, tell you, oh, you know, you got to do it this way or do it that way, you know. And I think a lot of it comes from most engineers are really, you know, musicians, and they're frustrated, and everybody thinks they're George Martin. You know, I'm being sarcastic, of course, but, you know, he's the pinnacle of record producers, right? You know, I mean, that guy was just, you know, phenomenal, you know, I mean, second to none. Really, you know, in the pop world. So, you know, everybody wants to, you know, be George Martin is what I say, you know, and all engineers think that they know better than the musician. And that is so not how it is, you know. Yeah. So it's crazy to me that, you know, people do exactly what you say, you know, they'll push their opinion. No, you got to do it this way. Or even after you leave, they'll change your part and play you something. Oh, this is how it should be. You know, I mean, that's just insane to me.
Well, it's, yeah. Equally insane to me, and because I'm a little older than you, I used to go to these legendary recording studios back, oh my God, when I was in high school, because I was studying from a few people that were really big in the recording field in New York, and they would take me and they would say, would you like to come to a session? Because I know you're interested in being a musician. Absolutely. They said, okay, you're going to be a gopher. You know, and being 17 years old, you're going, what's a gopher? Well, you're going to go for corned beef. You're going to go for soft drinks. You know.
Yeah, you're going to go for coffee. Right.
Right. I said, whatever you need. So I would go and I would see these legendary studio session players play, you know, just first take, play it. But everyone had a position. You had the conductor. You had the hand copyist. You had the songwriter, you had the musicians, you had the engineers. And I remember back then, and I know you know about this too, it was all reel to reel. And you would sure. have one or two engineers behind the console, you know, with the faders, and that was their job. I mean, they were not hired to do anything else. And
that's right. We used to call, you know, some of us were called tape ops because we were operating the tape machines, you know, specifically doing that and editing tape. Yeah. So absolutely.
You'll find this fascinating. I know I'm veering off a little bit, but this is all connected. One of my favorite producers, engineers is Tom Dowd. And I know you know about
him.
Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
My God, you know, legendary recordings. I was watching something on YouTube just this past week. I had no idea that he invented the faders.
Wow. I didn't know that either.
Isn't it amazing?
That's amazing.
You know, he was in the studio for so long. I mean, for many years, he did everything from, oh my God, Charlie Parker all the way up to the Allman Brothers. I mean,
yeah.
You don't find engineers or producers that have such a span. But since he was always, he practically lived in the studios, he said, why do I have to turn a knob to turn the volume up? He invented that.
Wow.
Yeah, that's fascinating, you know.
Well, thank you, Tom Dowd, for that.
Because
certainly has, you know, revolutionized, you know, what we do in the studio.
Absolutely.
Sure.
And speaking of studios, let's talk about your engineering credits that include work at Abbey Road Studios in London, where the Beatles and other iconic artists have recorded. So what project was that for?
Yeah, that was certainly, you know, one of the highlights of my career. I mean, so it wasn't anything that was commercially available, but I have a client. His name is Carlos Aram, and his son Michael is really a prodigy pianist. He's gone on to be, he studied at, I want to say it's USC. might be UCLA, but at any rate, he's probably about 27 or 28 now, but he's a professor there already. You know, he's toured the world. He played in Steve Vai's band. All kinds of Sony, Disney artists he plays with. So anyway, but back to the story is that, you know, Carlos and was a, you know, huge Beatle fan, as am I, and you know, he wanted to go there and do a session with his son Michael and some of his friends, and we flew over to London and spent a week there and recorded in Studio 2. Yeah, so I mean, you know, that's the studio, obviously, where the Beatles did 90% of their recordings throughout their career. You know, and yeah, it was just an amazing experience.
You must have been pinching yourself to know that you were behind the console where George Martin sat. And for my young listeners, George Martin was the legendary producer and arranger for the legendary Beatles albums. I mean, that must have been very surreal for you.
Yeah, you know, when I first came in, you know, it was just, you know, you're definitely awestruck. And let me just revert back that I was around Frank Sinatra. So I was around, you know, some of the biggest people in entertainment, you know, and I usually, you know, that doesn't happen to me. You know, I've met, you know, many other people and, you know, okay, yeah, they're just, you know, a person like you and me. They put their shoes on the same way we do. But being in Abbey Road, that's, you know, that is obviously the pinnacle of recording studios. So, yeah, when I first got there, it was a little... intimidating, but once we got to work, you know, it was the same thing. It was work, you know, and, you know, but every once in a while I look around and I'd say, wow, look where I'm at. This is wild.
Did you sit down at the piano where Lennon or McCartney performed?
Oh yeah. We recorded on the Let It Be piano. Oh. Absolutely.
Oh man.
You know, I mean, some of the gear, you know, they had sold off, you know, I don't know why they did in the 80s, but you know, most of the iconic stuff is still there for sure. But just to be in that room and in that same space where, you know, all of those legendary songs were recorded, and, you know, I actually played guitar on a couple songs, and I was in the room by myself, you know, for a while. And it was just really, you know, an amazing experience. You know, I mean, I truly felt that I was feeling, you know, John and George in that room at the same time when I was playing. You know, I'm sure it was just, you know, me being such a fan, but I felt something there. It was just a very moving experience for me.
So let's tie that into the famous Shorefire Recording Studios in Long Branch, New Jersey, which is your studio now for how many years?
I purchased Shorefire in 1995, so I guess I'm going on, it'll be almost 28 years in January. Well, it will be 28 years in January.
So you purchased that from the original owner, Tom Elliott, and in the purchase of it, did the original gear and equipment come as part of Shorefire purchase?
Yeah, so whatever gear was there when I purchased the studio was included. Yeah, there wasn't... A great amount of equipment, but there was a lot of really great gear. I mean, there a Yamaha C3 conservatory piano was there. It was a 1960 Hammond B3 and Leslie 122. There was a drum set. There was a guitar amp. There was a bass amp. There were some mics, obviously a recording console, a tape, you know, 2-inch tape machine. So, you know, the basics were there in place already. So yeah, all that was there. And then of course, over, you know, the course of my tenure there, I've brought a lot of different equipment in, and I had another studio prior to that for about 12 years in Asbury Park that, you know, I had brought, you know, all of the equipment that I had, you know, procured and at that time over as well. So
have you modified and or upgraded Shorefire in the years that you've owned it?
Well, minutely. I mean, I've, you know, the upgrades for me are the equipment purchases and things that I've brought in. You know, I purchased a different console in 2005. You know, so for me, that was like the biggest upgrade that was made to the studio. Again, going back a little bit, talking about my influences, you know, with the Stones and the Beatles and Led Zeppelin, the Who, and all those bands from, excuse me, from, you know, that era of rock and roll. In my research, I found out they all recorded on one specific console, not just, but one brand, and it's called a Helios, Helios. So, you know, back then, you know, I was still kind of, you know, really into, you know, trying to emulate that sound. So I scoured the world, and when I found one and had enough money, I purchased a Helios console for the studio. So that was, you know, the biggest upgrade I did, I would say, you know, from an equipment purchase. Of course, you know, I've purchased many microphones and EQs and compressors and all stuff that, you know, I felt the studio needed. And excuse me. But at the time, you know, when I even first started getting into the recording thing, I knew, you know, that what the value of a good piece of equipment was. So I always, you know, tried to buy the best tool that I could at the time, as opposed to, you know, I'll get this for now. You know, it's not really what I want. So if I couldn't afford it, I wouldn't buy it until I could afford, you know, what I felt I needed, you know, for the studio.
Well, let me add on to that for, especially for my young listeners. If you own and operate a recording studio, one of the biggest things you have to do is list your equipment, your gear, because the people coming in obviously know the type of equipment they like to operate and be recorded by. And that's probably why you get a lot of clients that go, oh, I love what you have here. I know about the studio. I love how big the room is, and that has a lot to do with the sound.
Yeah, I mean, all of those are definitely contributing factors. You know, I would think that, you know, I bring a little something to the table, you know, because of what I do. But yeah, the room for sure, you know, that there are not many rooms left in New Jersey, or I would say even on the East Coast of America, for that matter, the size of Shorefire, you know. So, you know, that's, you know, I think a big, you know, drawing factor is, like, if bands want to come in and record live, I can accommodate that. I have four different isolation areas. So, you know, I can set the drummer up out in the main room, but yet I could isolate a guitar amplifier. I could isolate the Leslie part of the organ. I can isolate a bass amplifier. But all the musicians are still out in the room playing next to each other and together. So, for instance, if they do a great take and, you know, the bass player makes a mistake or two, you know, we can go back and punch in his parts because his amplifier was isolated from the, you know, the drum. So his drums weren't bleeding into the bass microphone on his amplifier, or whatever the case may be. Yeah, so I do get a lot of that because of those capabilities at the studio, and I can accommodate that.
And recording facilities back in the 60s, 70s, they would purchase these huge rooms because most bands would record live, like Abbey Road. You know, you can get a whole orchestra in there, and from the size that you have, which is really huge, it's almost like Abbey Road, I would say, you can get a small orchestra in there.
Yeah, you can. And yeah, that was the you know, the goal back then, you know, was to be able to accommodate, you know, orchestras and be able to play live. You know, I mean, things have certainly changed now. You know, I mean, most studios are in people's, you know, bedrooms for, you know, or in their homes, in their basements.
Right.
They don't have those kinds of spaces. And it's not necessary. You don't necessarily need it for a lot of music that's being, you know, produced today. If it's, you know, pop music, dance music, whatever. I mean, even, you know, people, you know, just to do their own overdubs, you know, that they could have, you know, just a small space that they've turned into an area where they can record. So, you know, things have definitely changed. You know, I'm not sure, you know, it's for the better or for the worse, but, you know, it's different for sure.
So speaking about change in your industry, what are your thoughts about analog recording versus digital recording? And what do you prefer and why?
No, great questions. Yeah, you know, the advent of the digital audio workstation, DAW for short, has brought a whole new revolution in the recording industry, you know, where anyone could purchase a computer, some software, a mic, you know, a little interface, and they're making records in their home. You know, so that's great. You know, I mean, I applaud that technology for people to be able to work out, you know, if they want to work out their song ideas. And like I said, you know, even if you take it to the next step, you know, and you want to do your own overdubs on stuff like that, it's wonderful. And I'm a big proponent of the digital recording. You know, there's so many advantages as opposed to disadvantage. The main disadvantage for me is the sound. unfortunately, you know, for my ears, nothing sounds like analog tape.
Oh, no, absolutely.
But the, yeah, but the disadvantage is that you can't do what you could do with it. You could do digitally in the computer, you know, the way you can manipulate it and you know, do things that, you know, would take forever, you know, to do on analog tape or not even be able to do on analog tape. You know, it's just one of the things, for instance, is if I'm doing a mix for a client, and this is kind of the way that I, you know, run the studio, it's a little bit of a hybrid thing is, you know, I'll try and record everything as much as possible, you know, analog, you know, through all of the, you know, the microphones and the mic pre, you know, external mic pre's and compressors, all that stuff. But once it's recorded and we get to the mix stage, I'll try and keep everything pretty much in the computer, except we'll break it out of the box. So in other words, it's not being all mixed inside of the computer. You're mixing, but I'm also bringing the audio back through the console to get the sonic footprint, for lack of a better term, of the console. But I'm using all of the digital advantages that we have in terms of automation and plugins and being able to totally recall it. And that's why I do it, is that, you know, I if we do a mix and somebody goes home and 2 days later they want to make a change, you know, it's recalled instantaneously, or a week later, or a month, or a year. Or I even had a client who just came in 10 years later and we're working on stuff 10 years that, you know, and it's exactly the way I left it 10 years ago. And to try and emulate that or recreate that in the analog world, it's next to impossible. I mean, you'd have to take pictures and write these massive notes, and even that, you know, it would never be exactly the same as it is when you do it digitally. So there, again, the advantages far outweigh the disadvantages.
Not to mention the years before digital, you had analog, you had reel-to-reel recording. And if you had to make splices, you know, cut it, you know, the engineer would have one hand on the left reel, one hand on the right reel. You would hear the sound to say, are we cutting here? And you'd have to have phenomenal ears to say, no, a little bit left, a little bit right. And then you would pray. Right. You would cross yourself to go.
In nome de Padre, Filii, Spiritus Sancti, Amen.
Right. And once it's done, it's done.
Yeah. Well, you know, but there's something to be said for that, you know, and that was, you know, kind of the beauty of recording, you know, on analog tape is that, you know, you had to be able to play, you had to be able to sing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when you went into record, it was destructive. Like if you had a performance there and you said, yeah, well, let's try it again. I think we could do, let's punch in the guitar solo here. You know, if you didn't play it right, you had to do it over and over until you got it, as opposed to today where in digital, you know, you can undo it. You know, it's non-destructive. You could do multiple playlists and comp it later, you know. So, again, you know, there's good and bad about everything.
So share with my listeners the roster of famous South Jersey music artists that have recorded at Shorefire that include Bruce Springsteen and Bon Jovi. And then share with my listeners how you and I met and what recording projects we have worked together at Shorefire.
Yeah, I mean, so Shorefire, you know, since, you know, it's been open since 1978, it's pretty much seen everybody and anyone from the area, you know, starting, you know, of course, with Bruce and, you know, Bon Jovi, you know, so everyone, Skid Row, Southside Johnny, Monster Magnet. I mean, you know, and any band, you know, or artist that was, you know, from the area, you know, back in the day, if they wanted to stay local and record, you know, Shorefire was the place to go to. But, you know, as artists became more and more successful, they were obviously able to build their own recording studios. And, you know, so a lot of that has certainly, you know, gone by the wayside as far as, you know, Bruce obviously has a big studio in his house. And, you know, so most of the, you know, I don't really see those types of people anymore. So the bread and butter of my business has certainly been local talent and local musicians, and as the way it should be, you know. And so in answer to your next question, you know, I'm pretty sure one of our first, you know, meetings and working together was with one of my oldest and dearest friends, Sandy Sasso. And again, I have to go back and relate the story of Blue Note Music. Well, Sandy and her husband, Charlie, were the owners of Blue Note Music when I first started, you know, playing guitar. They had these music stores in the Jersey Shore area. They had one in Long Branch, which was their original store. They had one in Belmar, which was their second store. And then they had a third one in Point Pleasant in Ocean County. So really, Sandy and Charlie are like my oldest friends from the shore. I've known them, you know, almost 50 years, which is quite amazing to me. I'm pretty sure one of our earliest encounters was working on Sandy's big band record. Was it called Nick? Was it called Nick's Grill, that record? Was that one?
That's right. Yeah. What do you remember about that and, you know, us meeting? Because after that, we also did a number of different recording projects that you called me on or told different producers about me and we would record.
Yeah, you know, Sandy's session was, you know, really great for me because, you know, it was, we hooked up again after many years of, not that we hadn't spoken or talked, but, you know, we hadn't seen each other in some time. You know, I mean, I had gotten married and I was raising my family, whatever, you know. But when Sandy, you know, gave me a call and she wanted to do this record, it was just like, yeah, we got to do this, you know. So, and for me, it was really a great experience because not that I have never did it before, not that great English, not that I had never worked on a project like that before, but it was a big band thing. It was a little bit more swing. It was more standards, you know. I guess, I don't know if it's fortunate or unfortunately, but I got pigeonholed as to being this kind of rock and roll guy. Like that's the only thing that I could record. Like, you know, I didn't know how to record a drum set if it wasn't a rock guy playing, you know, which just does, you know, really, you know, I mean, if somebody comes in and they're playing the drums, you know, whether they're, you know, they're doing a jazz date or whatever it is, you know, I mean, I'm going to record the drum set and make it sound the way it sounds in the room. I'm not going to, you know, put distortion on the drums and make it sound like, you know, something, you know, totally 180 degrees opposite of what it's supposed to be, you know. So it was just a strange concept to me. But at any rate, Sandy's, you know, session was just great because I knew that she was going to have phenomenal players on it. Everybody's going to have chops, right? And we cut it, you know, the whole rhythm section live. You know, it was, you know, it was drums, it was bass. I mean, there was a upright bass. You know, there was guitar, there was keyboards, and then of course, you know, you came in and did your magic with your horns, with your arrangement and your playing and your section. So it was just a wonderful project to record and mix.
Well, thank you. That was between 2007 and 2008. But when she first told me where she wanted to record, I said, I know of Shorefire. I've never recorded there, but I know of it, you know, mostly as a rock and roll place. And she said, well, my friend Joey DeMeo has a great, you know, he's taken over the studio. It's got a magnificent sound. I want you to come visit with me. You know, I said, okay. And she said, you know, let's, you know, take one song. Let's see how it goes. And so I have the stereotypical thing in my head. Well, it's a rock and roll studio. But after I recorded one song there, you know, I was hooked. I mean, you and I clicked right away. The sound you got on every instrument was fantastic. The product was really great. We were thrilled. It was always phenomenal just to know I was going to go there. Okay, tonight we're going to do these two songs or, you know, these tracks or just woodwinds or just brass. To this day, when I put that album on, which is not that often, I still smile, not because I did it, but because it came off. We captured that magic in a bottle. So thanks to you, your magnificence, you know, the way you ran the studio, your knowledge of that room, the microphones, the placement, and the mixing, you were very kind in letting me, you know, co-mix it with you at certain times. And then, of course, you did, you know, the final and the mastering, you know, you took care of all that. But yeah, I had a great experience with that. So thank you.
Well, no, thank you, Scott. I mean, I appreciate all the kind words, but, you know, it was a team effort, you know. And again, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but yeah, you know, the rock and roll thing, it's great, you know, and of course, you know, I love doing it, but, you know, I love all kinds of music, you know, and I've recorded all kinds of music through my career. I've recorded rap, I've recorded jazz, I've recorded country, you know, I've recorded classical music, you know, so, you know, just because I have long hair and I play in a rock and roll band doesn't mean that's all I could do, you know. So, but I think at this point in my career, you know, people get that, you know. So I think that I'm past that part of it, which is good.
You know, a real true great engineer has to have a great foundation as a musician, and you certainly have that, and you have great ears, and that's what it takes. Like Sandy,
yeah, that's part of it. Yeah,
Sandy is a great vocalist, you know, big band vocalist and combo vocalist. She commands an audience, but she was never in the studio, and she was quite nervous. But you know, I helped her every time we were there, and you know, we would hear the playbacks, and she was, you know, extremely excited and happy. And we walked her through it. But after that, she had, you know, two or three other albums that she did, you know, actually three other albums on her own. So I'm very proud of what she's done in her recording career. And we had a great time there. So once again, thank you for all that.
Well, my pleasure. Yeah, it was a great experience for sure. You know, and hopefully we'll do it again in the future.
Oh, I would love to. So yeah. In order for my listeners to get a sense of who you are as a recording engineer and as an artist on your own, please pick two or three tracks from your catalog of recording projects that I can filter excerpts into this interview as you talk about them now.
So one of the tracks that I would love for you to play is from an artist. His name is Peter Viteska, and he has a band called Peter V and Blues Train. I've kind of become like the blues guy around the Jersey Shore area. You know, I get a lot of blues bands coming in, and again, that, and I think a lot of it is because of the fact that, you know, blues guys like to play together live. You know, there's not a lot of we don't chord the drums first and then overdub the bass and overdub the guitars and overdub, you know, everything. You know, these guys go in and play kind of old school style. So I think that this particular song, you know, captures that. I mean, there's a little bit of production in the beginning of the song, but what you're hearing is pretty much live. You know, the whole track. There might have been, I think, maybe a harmonica overdub after the fact, but and the vocals were cut after the fact. But the rhythm track is all live. You know, I mean, I don't think it was one take, but it might have been a couple of takes before we got the performance. Darling. I love all kinds of music, you know, blues and is certainly high up there for me, you know, because of the guitar playing aspect of it. You know, there's a lot of great blues guitar players, and I certainly appreciate that for sure.
Absolutely. And if I can make a suggestion, if you don't mind,
of course not,
because in piggybacking on what we just talked about, that the perception is, well, that's a rock and roll recording studio. Well, I just mentioned that we did a big band album there, jazz. For the people listening and for the seasoned musicians out there and looking for a space to record that are jazz musicians, you know, contemporary musicians thinking of recording, look no further. You've got to consider Shorefire. This is one of the tracks that I produced and arranged on Sandy's Mixed Grill album. As I mentioned, this is back in 2007, 2008. During this recording project, she calls me and says, "Hey, I've got a great novelty piece that I would really like you to work up an arrangement. And it's called Ain't Nobody Here But Us Chickens." Perfect title for a novelty song. And this song was originally recorded by saxophonist and singer and entertainer Louis Jordan. With his Timpani 5, this was recorded back in 1946. He did a lot of boogie-woogie and what we call a jump swing. Very, very fast type of song. But what Sandy wanted me to do is to arrange it in her style, you know, bring the tempo down, you know, beautiful, you know, swing groove, you know, with the whole big band, and to, you know, have a flavor of what Louis Jordan did there. This is Ain't Nobody Here But Us Chickens, if it gives you an idea or a sense of why you should record at Shorefire if you're a jazz musician.
Taking the air, locked up the bonnet with the greatest of care. Down in the hen house, something stirred when he shouted, "Who's there?" This is what he heard: "There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. So quiet yourself and stop that fuss. There ain't nobody here but us. We chickens trying to sleep, and you butt in. And hobble, 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 hobble with your chin. There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. You're stomping around, you're shaking the ground. You're kicking up an awful dust. We chickens trying to sleep, and you butt in. And hobble, 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 hobble."
So, as a recording engineer and businessman, how important is the use of social media to you?
Yeah, you know, social media is a necessary evil. You know, I mean, obviously, I have a website. You know, I have a Facebook page. I have an Instagram page. I have a Twitter page. You know, but, you know, being a sole proprietor, it's, you know, sometimes a little daunting to try and keep up on all of those things. So, you know, I do, you know, when there's something that I feel like it's, you know, something interesting that, you know, whoever might get something from it, I'll put a post up, you know, whether it's a live video or it's a picture of an interesting piece of equipment. The other day I had this really wonderful harmonica player, Mikey Jr., come in and play some harp through an old Fender amplifier that I have at the studio, and it just has this amazing sound. I mean, this guy is just, you know, a great talent on top of it. And again, it goes back to, you know, it's a lot of it's him and how he plays and how what he does. But yeah, you know, so I put that up, you know, because this guy was blowing his harp through this amp and it just filled up the whole room. So I thought people would get, you know, be interested in seeing something like that. So yeah, I mean, it's tough to keep up on it, but you know, you have to do it, you know. So it's all part of trying to, you know, keep your potential clients you know, interactive with you and seeing that you're, you know, at least viable and doing something out there. So.
Absolutely. I agree with everything you're saying. And I did catch that Instagram video. It was really great, man.
Yeah.
You got the sense that he was a great musician and is in a great room and, you know, just having a great time.
Yeah. Well, that's hopefully, you know, that's what we try and do at Shorefire.
Do you have any musical or life philosophies or catchphrases that you live by?
Well, the one I always say is never trust anybody who doesn't like the Beatles. So I say that a lot. And, you know, of course, I'm joking, you know, pretty much. But, you know, really, you know, it's if you don't like the Beatles, where are we going?
Do you have any upcoming recording projects at Shorefire that you'd like to announce?
Yeah, you know, I mean, Shorefire is relatively, you know, consistent, you know, I mean, there's always something going on, you know, I mean, I always have new projects coming in, you know, doing different things. So nothing specific that I would like to announce, you know, sometimes I'm in the middle of starting a new project with a band or a solo artist. Sometimes we're, you know, in the middle of doing some overdubs. Sometimes I'm in the middle of mixing. So, you know, I've been blessed, Scott, you know, to be able to scratch out a career for almost 40 years. That's something I love doing, and I still love doing it, you know. So, you know, the good Lord's been very good to me. So I certainly, you know, I can't, I have, I'm one of the luckiest men in the world, to be honest with you, as far as I'm concerned. You have your professional life, you have your family life, you know, you should have your, you know, personal life where you do things that you enjoy. And, you know, and I have all of that. You know, I'm married with three beautiful children. You know, I'm blessed there, of course. You know, I have my business that, you know, is functioning and thriving. And, you know, I have bands that I play with. You know, I have my original band that you played earlier, the Killing Floor Project, where, you know, we get together and write songs at our own kind of time frame and tempo. We're not under any deadlines from, you know, Warner Brother Records to put a record out. You know, we do it at our own pace because we enjoy it. And I play in a Paul McCartney tribute band called Pure McCartney. You know, how much more could I possibly want out of life? You know, I get to play the music I love with the people I love doing it with, you know. So it's, you know, again, I'm a very lucky person.
How did I miss that you were in that tribute band? I follow you guys.
I'm not sure. You know, I mean, you know, we've only been doing it really. August was a year that we did our first gig. I mean, we were, you know, we kind of, you know, started it right before COVID, you know, when we had every plans of going out and playing in 2020. And of course, COVID hit and, you know, it put a damper on it. And then, you know, we had a couple of member changes in there. So we really didn't get out till August of 2021. So, yeah, I mean, we've been playing, you know, and of course, by the name Pure McCartney, we do everything that Sir Paul, you know, not everything, but, you know, it's only based upon, you know, Paul McCartney music, you know, obviously, you know, Beatles that he, you know, sang, you know, wrote, solo recordings, Wings, you know, so we try and capture, you know, his whole career, you know, as far as, you know, his catalog of music.
Wow. Oh, man. Yeah. I'm more intrigued now. I've been following you guys for a while, but and my schedule's dictating that I can't often see certain people that I would love to see. But when the opportunity arises, you'll see me in the audience. I'll come up and say hi. Where can my listeners find you and your studio on social media?
So my website is surefirerecordingstudios.com. You know, just put in Surefire Recording Studios in your Google search, I'll pop up. You know, that's the main one. You know, that has, you know, pretty much, you know, everything that, you know, that I do, you know, equipment, pictures, all that good stuff. You know, I have a Facebook, Surefire Recording, an Instagram, Surefire Studios, Twitter, Surefire. So just put in Surefire, but it's spelled like down the shore, S-H-O-R-E, not like the microphone, S-H-U-R-E, or, you know, the word shore, S-U-R-E. It's shore, like down the shore, S-H-O-R-E. So if you put that in, Surefire, I'll pop up.
Well, Joey, I can't thank you enough. I loved being on this end of the music business to interview you. I've seen you behind the glass at a, you know, console at your recording studio for years. But this is another angle for me. You've been very giving of your time, and I thank you so very much for this. And I'm sure my listeners have appreciated everything that you've been talking about. And I hope the musicians that are out there are driven to contact you and schedule a recording session at Surefire.
Well, I can't thank you enough, Scott, for reaching out and asking me to be on your show. It's been, you know, absolutely wonderful to talk with you and to catch up a little bit. It was my pleasure. And I hope your listeners, you know, get a little something out of it. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, we got many more to come.
Well, I look forward to that. Okay, Joey, have a great day. I look forward to speaking to you once again. Take care now.
You too, Scott, and your listeners. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for joining me on today's show. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and could hear why my guest got chops. You can follow my podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or Anchor.fm, and stay connected between episodes on Instagram at Gotchops Podcast. Join me on the next episode when we discover why my next guest got chops.